Welcome to One Mic, and I'm your host, Country Boy. This episode is about William Edward Burghardt Du Bois. When I was working on the previous episode, episode 8, I had plans of doing a bio on Booker T. Washington and a bio on W.E.B. Du Bois with a talk about their disagreements. What ended up happening is that Booker T. Washington's life and times was really vast, and I don't feel like it did him justice to gloss over his life so that I could shoehorn W.E.B. Du Bois' life into one episode. So what ended up happening is the previous episode was just about Booker T. Washington's and his disagreement with Du Bois, and this episode is going to solely focus on Du Bois and his life work and his opinions. I think you're going to enjoy it. I enjoyed creating it, so I'm hoping that you enjoy it as much as I enjoy creating it. You know what to do. If you like this, you love this, please consider donating to my Patreon page. You can find that down in the description. You know, you can give as much as little as $2. I think we have also have some $10 Patreons. Please consider voting for us on Apple Podcasts. Give us 5 stars. We need all the reviews that we can get. And follow the cut for all of your pop culture needs. And anyway, without further ado, let's get started. William Edward Burghardt Du Bois was born on February 23rd of 1868 in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, to Mary Burghardt and Alfred Du Bois. The mother's family was among the oldest inhabitants in the area, and his father was born in Haiti. His family left when Alfred was just a small boy. The Burghardts lived in Great Barrington on the Edgemont Plain in a tiny black community. Great Barrington was predominantly white, mostly English and Dutch ancestry. Du Bois would recall that there was perhaps 25, no more than 50 African Americans in his town of a population of 5,000. By the time Du Bois was 11, both his father and his grandparents were dead, and they had lost their family home due to their debt. As money began to get tighter, William's mother, Mary, had a stroke, which left her weak and weary with perhaps a withered arm. She would continue to work over the years, but William would chop wood and mow lawns and deliver white newspapers to assist the household. From the time that he entered school, he was a standout. He was a stellar student and the only black in his class and his schools for much of his youth. When he spoke at his graduation's commencement, his speech would be about white abolitionist Wendell Phillips, who before the Civil War crusaded against slavery and for the full citizenship of blacks and women. Phillips, he believed that capitalism was the root of many social ills because it put profit over the good of the people. But Du Bois' speech would only focus on the abolitionist part of his background and garnered thunderous applause. William was the first black and youngest graduate to graduate from Great Barrington High School, and he was only 16 years old. Du Bois had his sights set on going to Harvard, but he had very little money. He spent a year working construction to earn money for school before a group of white townsfolk in Great Barrington devised a plan to donate $25 a year for Du Bois to attend Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee. Du Bois winced at the idea of attending Fisk because he wanted to go to Harvard, but he wasn't stupid. He understood that Fisk was much better than Great Barrington. In August 1885, Du Bois began at Fisk. He was so exhilarated not to be in a minority and to be amongst other black students. But once again, William did well academically, from Greek to Latin to philosophy and physics. This would be his first time living in the South and his first time seeing how hard it was for a poor black person in the South, where scores of blacks were lynched and murdered. William wrote that lynching was a continuing and reoccurring horror during his college days. Each death was like a scar upon my soul. He recalled that whenever he left campus, he was careful and braced for continued racial insult. Du Bois would receive his bachelor's from Fisk in 1888 and head to Cambridge, Mass., where his dream would finally come true. He would begin attending Harvard, determined to get his PhD. His acceptance to Harvard came with a scholarship, but Du Bois would have to earn his bachelor's degree first. So he entered Harvard as a junior. he stated that he was not at Harvard to make friends, which was most likely a defense mechanism against negative encounters with white students. By October of 1890, he had earned his bachelor's degree in philosophy and graduated cum laude. Du Bois wanted to get his PhD in sociology, but Harvard didn't have such a department. So, considering the economics of his PhD, he decided to get his PhD in history. Du Bois wanted to study abroad, but of course, money was always a struggle. He got his hopes up when a speech from former President Rutherford B. Hayes. Hayes was the head of the Slater Fund for Negro Education and created an endowment of $1 million by white industrialist John Fox Slater. In a speech, Hayes mentioned the Slater Initiative. If there was any colored man in the South that whom we found had a great talent for art or literature or a special aptitude for study, the Slater Fund would give that young man financial aid to study abroad or to earn an advanced degree. The bad news was is that Hayes doubted there was a black man that would qualify. Du Bois sent a letter to Hayes informing him of his academic credentials, several fellowships that Harvard had given him, and listed 10 distinguished gentlemen to provide references, including the president of Harvard, Charles Eliot. Hayes would end up telling Du Bois that the initiative had been scrapped, and Du Bois was pissed and wrote Hayes a letter stating that you owe an apology to the Negro people. Hayes would, in short, tell him that maybe next year, kid. A year later, in April of 1892, Du Bois wrote Hayes another letter stating that it had been another year and he had received his master's degree and was also presenting his thesis at the annual meeting of the American Historical Association in Washington, D.C. His thesis would be on slavery and the importation of kidnapped Africans and why it didn't end as mandated by law. Du Bois, of course, didn't give Hayes the details on the dissertation, but he forcefully asked the Slater Fund to give him a scholarship or a loan or suggest someone that would lend him the money. Persistence would pay off, as the Slater Fund would grant Du Bois $750, half in cash and half of the form of a loan, to support him 1 year in Germany at some university. That some university would turn out to be the University of Berlin. Du Bois' encounters with white Europeans were mostly positive. None of them recoiled or menaced him because of the color of his skin. He fell in love with Europe's cultural offerings, from museums to monuments, and he saw white Europeans as just better and more human than their American cousins, which was ironic considering that European nations had colonies in Asia and the West Indies and ruled over tens of millions of people of color. Du Bois was able to study abroad, but he wouldn't be able to get his PhD in Germany. The Slater Fund honored his request for financial aid, but wouldn't honor another. After experiencing as much of Europe as he could in 1894, he made his way back to his, as he called it, nigger-hating America. In 1895, he became the first African-American to earn their PhD from Harvard University. Du Bois would begin applying for employment at positions at Tuskegee and Hampton Institute and other majority black schools. The first to send a positive reply was Wilberforce University in Ohio. Wilberforce offered Du Bois $800 a year to teach Greek and Latin, and he excitedly accepted without fielding any offers from the other institutions. Wilberforce was awful for Du Bois. On top of Latin and Greek, he had to teach German, English, and history. Workload was not the issue, but he only liked it on his own terms. He would have happily taught sociology 1,000 times, but he was told no sociology. Also, he knew that Wilberforce was a religious school. He didn't expect their prayer meetings and other religious activities to be so pervasive and mandatory. Du Bois refused to fake faith to fit in, and while he had a very poor view of organized religion, the clerics loved him. At the Commencement Day speech in 1895, Episcopal priest Alexander Cumel was the speaker. His address was about the solution of problems of duty and destiny of man. In it, he stressed that people did not live on bread alone. Behind all the strivings for life necessities of food, shelter, and clothing, there was a more profound problem. Labor strikes, for example, weren't just about getting higher wages and about better working conditions, but were about absorbing the moral problem which agitated the souls of men. Cromwell insisted that it was the duty of people like Du Bois and the Wilberforce grads to devote themselves to alleviating what agitated the souls of Black folks. Black America's best and brightest were the only hope for the Black masses, he believed. In September of 1895, Booker T. Washington opened the Cotton States and International Expedition in Atlanta, largely before a white crowd, offering his solution to the Negro problems, at least as it pertained in the South. His main idea was that purely social Blacks and whites could be separate as the five fingers, yet one as the hand and all things essential for mutual progress. The speech was called for a compromise. Whites would let Blacks have economic opportunities without harassment, and Black folks would work hard, be law-abiding, and trust that in time, whites would deem them worthy of civil rights. The speech was the beginning of Booker T. Washington being stamped as the wise and safe leader for African Americans. Du Bois sent Washington a telegram congratulating of the speech, calling it a word fitly spoken, freedom to earn a living and build economically. Du Bois seemed to be working his way up to asking for a job, because later he would send a telegram asking, if you hear of any openings which you think I am fitted to fill, kindly let me know. Without any new job offers, Du Bois continued at Wilberforce until 1896. It wasn't until he accepted an assistant professorship at University of Pennsylvania at the suggestion of Susan P. Wharton. He was there to conduct a study of the city's Black community of Philadelphia, which many white critics held responsible for a rise in crime and disorder. The people behind the study wanted to prove that Philly was going to the dogs because of the Blacks, and of course, Du Bois had his own agenda. He felt that a Negro problem needed a systematic investigation and intelligent understanding, and the world was looking and thinking about race wrong. The research project was called the Philadelphia Negro, and despite his title, Philadelphia Negro was a bit smaller than the Philadelphia seems to imply. It was really a neighborhood study focusing on Central 7th Ward, a site in the city's oldest African-American community dating back to the colonial era. 7th Ward, by the time of the study, had roughly about 1,700 Blacks, or about one quarter of Philadelphia's 40,000 African-Americans. For 2 years, Du Bois and his wife lived in the heart of Philadelphia's 7th Ward within the poor quarter surrounding a college settlement on St. Mary Street. The Philadelphia Negro marked the first study of America's empirical sociology and represented Du Bois' quest to expose racism as a problem of ignorance. Du Bois personally interviewed several thousand residents, and his study documented the living conditions of poor African Americans enduring dilapidated housing, inadequate health care, disease, and violence. His findings revealed a heterogeneous community, a portion of which affirmed the reality of poverty, crime, and illiteracy. Addressing this imbalance, Du Bois emphasized socioeconomic and historical causes, notably the exclusion of Blacks from the city's premier industrial jobs, single-family homes, and the formidable legacy of slavery and a checkered past of race relations. Du Bois contended that crime and poverty in the Black community were manifestations of institutionalized and structural racism. While his sponsors had hoped that his analysis would justify sweeping reforms in the Black community, Du Bois, meanwhile, preferred to demonstrate that Black possess their own internal structural class and should not be judged solely on the lowest rung in the Black community. The imagined Negro problem, as he argued, was not one problem, but rather a myriad of social issues having to do less with monolithic Black social pathology than whites with enforcement of racial discrimination and provisional unequal opportunity. After study was completed in 1897, Du Bois and his family would move to the city of Atlanta, where he taught economics and history at the University of Atlanta. Unlike Wilberforce, AU was not the pitch for Du Bois. Atlanta was a large southern city with a very significant African-American population. There was a vibrant Black community, and diversity in the Black community existed in Atlanta, from the Black bourgeoisie to the Black middle class to the Black working class. So there was a vast array of African-Americans to study. Du Bois wanted to understand Black America in all its forms. White scholars who studied Blacks largely saw them as one big homogeneous mass. They did not differentiate between the social classes within the Black community. Du Bois was the first to do so from a scholarly standpoint to study diversity in between the Black community, and he did that in Atlanta. In Atlanta, Du Bois witnessed racism, lynching, Ku Klux Klan cross burnings, race riots, and disenfranchisement. In April of 1897, in Newnan, Georgia, about 40 miles west of Atlanta, a man by the name of Sam Holes was being hunted for killing his white employer, Alfred Cranford, in a pay dispute. Miss Cranford claimed that not only had a Black man murdered her husband, but he raped her also. The Atlanta Constitution would offer a $500 reward for Holes. Du Bois heard about the story and wrote a letter claiming for the attention to the facts and for a fair trial. A letter hoping that the Atlanta Constitution would publish. But on his way to the newspaper, he was met with the news that Sam Holes had been lynched and his knuckles were on exhibition at the local grocery store on Mitchell Street. The mob had decided that Holes didn't deserve a fair trial. They would rather castrate and burn his corpse. And after allowing his corpse to cool, they would remove body parts as souvenirs. To challenge these unspeakable acts, he would begin publishing papers in the Atlanta Monthly and other journals that explored and confronted discriminatory Southern society. A Chicago publishing company approached Du Bois in the early 1900s with a proposal to write a book. Publishers wanted him to compile a list of essays such as those previously published in the Atlanta Monthly. Du Bois at first was against the idea because he felt their books filled with essays always fell flat. But in the end, he relented, pulled together some pieces, then added his most explosive essay on Booker T. Washington. This compilation of unpublished papers led to what would be considered Du Bois' greatest work, The Souls of Black Folks, in 1903. In it, Du Bois wrote, "The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line." The Souls of Black Folks provided a provisional framework to which Du Bois addressed the problem of race and the distresses of reality of African-American life in America. Within its pages, he offered sharp criticism of African-American leader Booker T. Washington. Du Bois firmly opposed Washington's policies of accommodation and suggested that Washington's ideology practically accepted the inferiority of the Negro. While openly denouncing the protests of racial injustice and white violence that Du Bois felt was needed to break the bonds of racial oppression, the Masterful Souls of Black Folks made Du Bois one of the most famous African-Americans in the country. It was also around this time that Du Bois would serve as secretary for the first Pan-African Conference in London in 1900. Pan-African's ideals emerged in the late 19th century in response to European colonization and exploitation of the African continent. Pan-Africanist philosophy held that slavery and colonialism depended on and encouraged negative and unfounded categorizations of race and culture and the value of African people. This destructive belief in turn gave birth to the intensified forms of racism, the likes of which the Pan-Africanism sought to eliminate. Du Bois would later explain that European powers weren't truly interested in spreading European civilization as they claimed, but in the field of exploitation as they coveted raw materials like ivory, diamonds, copper, and rubber, which the land abounds. In a broader political concept, Pan-Africanist roots lied in the collective experience of African descendants in the New World. Africa assumed greater significance for some Blacks in the New World because of a few reasons. First, the increased futility of their campaign against racial equality in the United States led to some African Americans to demand voluntary repatriation to Africa. And next, for the first time, the term Africans, which had often been used by racism as a derogatory description, became a source of pride for early Black nationalists. In the initial meeting, which featured 30 delegates, mainly from England and the West Indies, but also attracted a few Africans and African Americans, Du Bois became the torchbearer of subsequent Pan-African conferences. The conference participants read papers on a variety of topics, including social and political, economic conditions of Blacks and the diaspora, the importance of independent nations governed by people of African descent, such as Ethiopia, Haiti, and Liberia, the legacy of slavery and European imperialism, the role of Africans in the world history, and the impact of Christianity on the African continent. While the Pan-African Congresses lacked financial and political power, they helped increase international awareness of racism and colonialism and laid the foundation for political independence in African nations. In July of 1905, Du Bois would also took a leadership role in organizing a group of African-American leaders and scholars in what became the Niagara Movement. The Niagara Movement was a civil rights group organized by Du Bois and William Monroe Trotter. The pair drafted a declaration of principles announcing at what the group stood for, in a word, justice for the black man, the right to vote throughout the nation, and equal opportunity for employment and education. Until racial injustice became a reality, the Niagara Movement would commit to agitation because of this. Persistent, manly agitation is the way to liberty towards the goal the Niagara Movement started and asked for cooperation of all men of all races. The group was opposed to the conservative platform of Booker T. Washington and his Tuskegee machine. They felt that Washington encouraged training in obsolete crafts based on Southern agriculture while ignoring the growing horrors of racial violence against African Americans. It was in response to this that they organized against Washington. The Niagara Movement attempted to bring about legal change. They drafted a list of demands, which included an end to segregation, anti-discrimination in unions, courts, and public accommodations, as well as equal economic and educational opportunities, as well as the right to vote for black men and women. While the movement had grown to almost 170 members in 34 states by 1906, it also encountered difficulties. Du Bois wanted the inclusion of women in the Niagara Movement, and William Monroe Trotter did not. William Monroe Trotter left the movement in 1908 to start his own group, the Negro American Political League. Although Niagara Movement attracted the attention of like-minded whites, it had very little impact on legislation or popular opinion. When a race riot broke out in Springfield, Illinois, when a white woman falsely accused a black man of assaulting her to cover up the fact that her boyfriend had beat her up, 8 blacks were killed and over 2,000 African Americans fled the city. Blacks had been attacked in the city where Abraham Lincoln had spent most of his life in the centennial of his birth. The white mob's battle cry was, "Curse the day that Lincoln freed the niggers." Black and white activists, including members of the Niagara Movement, felt that a more powerful interracial organization was needed to combat racism. Out of this concern, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People was formed. The Niagara Movement was considered the precursor to the NAACP, and they adopted many of the Niagara Movement's goals. Du Bois had hoped to simply fold the Niagara Movement into the NAACP, but Trotter couldn't see black progress being charted by a majority white organization. Trotter was up for fighting, but he would do it his own way. After leaving his professorship in Atlanta, Du Bois would form the central staff of the NAACP in November of 1910. Having been instrumental in the group's formation, he became the only African American on its executive board and, more importantly, the director of publications and research. That position assumed control of The Crisis, the official journal of the NAACP. The expanded economy provided blacks with a moderate economic and educational gains. Discrimination and violence and lynching were still rampant. Black anger and heightened consciousness combined with expanded literacy provided a growing audience for The Crisis. The journal expanded Du Bois' influence and audience beyond the academia to the public. In 1913, its regular circulation had reached 30,000, and by 1915, the magazine no longer needed a subsidy from the NAACP. It was a huge success and became very influential in the African-American community. Crisis informed people about important events, offered analysis, sold themes of black upliftment and civil rights, and continual endorsements and coverage of black and women's suffrage. Du Bois' voice dominated throughout as if they were his own personal journal. His authoritative editorials spoke about injustice, discriminatory practices, lynchings, miseducation, and widespread mistreatment of African Americans. Du Bois would not hesitate to confront whom he believed misled his people, covering his race relations and black culture with Du Bois' forthright style. In November 1915, Booker T. Washington died. He was known as the Negro in the United States. Du Bois didn't have any ill words for him as he spoke about him in The Crisis. He would call him the most distinguished Southern man since the Civil War, praising Washington for promoting black economic development. Before his passing, Washington's popularity had waned as Du Bois' rose. This was chiefly because of The Crisis. In early 1917, when President Woodrow Wilson addressed a joint session of Congress seeking to enter the United States in the First World War, he urged the world must be safe for democracy. The NAACP would fly banners asking, "Mr. President, why not make America safe for democracy?" Philip A. Randolph, the co-founder of another African American magazine called The Messengers, would also retort that we would rather make Georgia safe for the Negro. Du Bois hated war, and he also hated Woodrow Wilson in particular, because back in 1912, when Wilson was running for president, Wilson rallied the black vote for him and vowed to be a president of all people. But once Wilson was elected, he made the federal government, with all its bureaus and offices, Jim Crow, from eating facilities to restrooms, and he also fired most of the black servants. Despite his feelings about war and about Woodrow Wilson, he saw war as an opportunity for African Americans to demonstrate their patriotism and expected they'd be treated better once they returned home. Riding in the crisis, Du Bois called for African Americans to forget their special grievances and close ranks shoulder to shoulder with our white fellows and citizenships and aligned nations that were fighting for democracy. The debate over democracy and who would serve the United States was central to African Americans during the First World War. African Americans were expected to go fight, even though they were denied access to democracy at home and treated like second-class citizens and subjected to constant aggression and violence at home. Still, approximately 370,000 African Americans served in the armed forces in World War I. Du Bois would sail to Europe in 1918 to cover the Paris Peace Conference and would result in the Treaty of Versailles. In addition to covering the peace talk, Du Bois would also gather information on the heroics of black soldiers and the horrible treatment that some had received by white American hands. The end of war in 1918 marked a moment of truth. Du Bois, after returning home, many of these men sought freedoms that they were told World War I fought to preserve. But a reality set in. Du Bois had been proven wrong. Equal rights were not going to be extended to African Americans, and the violence against African Americans that preceded the war continued and worsened after its end. By 1919, Du Bois, both chastised and invigorated by what he witnessed during and after the war, understood that sustained struggle may lay ahead. "We sing, this country of ours, despite its better souls have done and have dreamt, it is yet a shameful land," he wrote in Crisis. "Make way for democracy. We saved it in France, and by great Jehovah, we will save it in the United States of America, or know the reason why." Mob violence in 36 cities across the country, lasting from April to November 1919, earned the moniker of the Red Summer for the bloodshed that targeted African Americans. These events compelled Du Bois to call for physically fighting back and also led to the NAACP becoming the civil rights organization of choice. Thanks in large part to Du Bois and the crisis, the NAACP had about 90,000 members and almost 300 branches all over the United States. Du Bois wasn't the only black man in the United States calling for black solidarity. Most notably, there was Marcus Garvey and his group, the UNIA, which called for black pride, black separatism, and black rule of sub-Saharan Africa. His early supporters were Ida B. Wells and Madam C.J. Walker. Madam C.J. Walker even financed the startup of Garvey's newspaper, Negro World. The UNIA was a threat to NAACP because it called for black separatism. It gave comfort to white separatists, thus gave them no reason to work with the NAACP in their crusade against Jim Crow. Du Bois cringed at Garvey's penchant for peasantry, the parades in which Garveyites would march in military uniforms. Du Bois simply couldn't appreciate the appeal and pride-boosting power that the marches had. Garvey called for millions of black people to immigrate to Liberia, and Du Bois thought this idea was absolutely ridiculous. In the crisis, Du Bois would state that Garvey had very serious defects, including dictatorial, domineering, and being inordinarily vain, and having absolutely no sense or flair for real organization. It was at this point that the agreement between Garvey and Du Bois became personal, Garvey stating that he only appreciates one type of men, and this is the cultured and refined type which lingers around universities and attends pink tea parties. Du Bois would call Garvey a little black man, ugly with intelligent eyes and having a big head. In response, Garvey would state, "What does Boyce mean by ugly?" stating that his light skin was a monstrosity. In 1924, Du Bois would claim that Garvey was the most dangerous enemy to the Negro race in America. He's either a lunatic or a traitor. And at the time, Garvey was out on bail appealing his conviction for mail fraud. But in 1925, his conviction was upheld and he began serving his 5-year sentence, to which Du Bois would begin attempting to call Calvin Coolidge to have his sentence commuted. The early 1920s was the start of a physical mass movement of African Americans from the South to the North, began in what would be known as the Great Migration. World War I would contribute to two effects: the increase of industrialized activity generated by the war effort, causing many Northern businesses to recruit African Americans living in the South to meet labor demands. Outside of the South, these workers experienced immeasurable increase in their wages, working conditions, social conditions. This was the beginning of an era known as the New Negro Movement, which promoted a renewed sense of racial pride, economic independence, and progressive politics, not only political, but also cultural and artistically. It would be known as the Negro Renaissance. At first, Du Bois was glad to see white publishers and producers bring black artistry to a wider view. He was a big booster of black artistry in the crisis. He wanted black writers to have a literary outlet. One of his best finds was Langston Hughes, but he also had black artists drawing and painting the covers of The Crisis. The Crisis would also launch artistic competitions in which writers and visual artists would receive cash prizes. Prize-winning plays would also be performed by the Quinois Players, a Harlem theater group which Du Bois co-founded. Du Bois would begin to grow sour on the Harlem Renaissance because he felt that so many works presented blacks in a terrible light. He couldn't stomach another novel about a prostitute, a gambler, or a crook. For blacks to write or paint whatever they felt like with no regard to how it might help or hinder the race was stupid. Du Bois would comment that "I don't give a damn for the art unless it is used for propaganda." He wanted black art to advance the cause of black equality. In 1924, Du Bois would visit Liberia representing President Calvin Coolidge at the inauguration ceremonies for new President Charles King. In addition to visiting Liberia, he spent time in Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Senegal, never knowing if his feet touched the same ground as his ancestors. He would remark in the Crisis on the ways the continent was behind the West, but stressed in another way it was more sublime. It was less hustle and bustle and much less materialism. He called Africa a place where the spirit longs to die. In 1929, the stock market crashed, and this was the tipping point for the Great Depression. He still had a job, but he was facing financial issues. So in 1923, he would start a visiting professorship at Atlanta University, and it gave him sorely needed distance from the NAACP. The Crisis was an affecting crisis. The NAACP was not depression-proof. Membership was down, and with belt tightening, the executive secretary, Walter White, wanted to use the resources for legal challenges against racial injustice. Because of this, there was talk of doing away with the Crisis. Circulation had dropped to below 25,000 and it was no longer self-supporting. Du Bois' radical thinking, like praising the USSR and ironically calling for the NAACP to back off fights against Jim Crow and devote more of their energy to strategies for black economic development. Black unemployment was at 50% and blacks were having a hard time. And he believed that during hard times called for something new. While he was away at Atlanta University, the Crisis was still his baby. He would continue to make editorial decisions and have a say in the magazine. In 1934, Du Bois would shock everyone when he wrote, "The thinking colored people of the United States must stop being stampeded by the word segregation." Du Bois asked black people to embrace voluntary segregation and close ranks around themselves. At this point, Du Bois had little hope in what he believed would be the end of prejudice. He no longer felt that racist whites were merely ignorant about black life and history, but they were mentally ill. He argued that fighting against discrimination didn't have to mean fighting for integration. Instead, the fight for school integration with whites campaigned for black schools to receive the same funding as white ones. Walter White's counterpoint is that he wanted everyone to know that NAACP in no way endorsed the views of Du Bois. Du Bois would hang in with the crisis, but in 1934, board members of the NAACP will vote forbidding officers from criticizing fellow officers in the crisis without Du Bois' approval. With this, Du Bois would tender his resignation. The board wouldn't accept it, believing there was still hope for peace between the NAACP and Du Bois. But in July of 1924, he would write NAACP a letter stating that I automatically cease to have any connection with the NAACP in any shape, form, or fashion. Without funding or a organizational base, Du Bois continued to critique American capitalism and racial equality. At the start of the Second World War, Du Bois urged blacks again to fight for democracy. We may sadly admit that the First World War did not bring us democracy, and nor will the Second, but Hitler has to be stopped. While the world was at war, Du Bois was at war with Atlanta University. He was at odds with the president, Rufus Clement. After being denied permission for an invitation at NYU to teach for a semester in July of 1944, he was pushed out at Atlanta University on a technicality of mandatory retirement at age 55. He was already 66 when he joined Atlanta University in 1934. He wasn't unemployed for long. The NAACP would invite him back as Director of Special Research, and he represented the organization at the first meeting of the United Nations. This reunion wouldn't be heavenly for Du Bois or the NAACP. He was given a small office with the wall he shared with Thurgood Marshall. After asking for one to accommodate himself, his secretary, his file cabinets, and his 2,500 books, Marshall would recall that Du Bois had arranged his office to dissuade visitors. The whole office was fenced in with books that ran all along the sides of the wall. Marshall, being a big fan of Du Bois growing up, having read The Crisis, one day attempted to break the ice. He said, "Look, Doc, your office and mine are side by side. You come in every morning and you just walk by." Du Bois would answer, "Yeah, that's one of my bad habits," and slam the door in his face. Walter White's main issue with Du Bois was not that he was aloof. It was that he was a wild card. He was still promoting voluntary segregation and was still criticizing Walter White's leadership. Plus, he still praising the USSR and increasingly associating himself with communists. All these things created major issues for NAACP leadership, so he left the organization for a second time in 1948. In July of 1950, Du Bois's first wife, Nina, died and was buried in Great Barrington next to other members of the Burkhardt family. Du Bois would describe Nina as loyal, dutiful wife, but he was on a whole, was not what you would describe as a good husband. His family was never the center of his life, and he was always striving to guide the world and certainly the Negro group. Later in 1950, he would run for U.S. Senate in New York on the ticket of the American Labor Platform. He did not expect to win, but hoped to guide the world with his message. Surprisingly, he will receive 210,000 votes, which was the equivalent of 4%. In 1951, Du Bois and its organization, Peace Information Center colleagues, would be ordered by the Justice Department to register as foreign agents. Back in 1950, the Peace Information Center was co-founded by Du Bois to keep Americans informed on matters of war and peace. The Peace Information Organization's agenda was to get people to sign a petition to ban atomic weapons so that what happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki would never happen again. After Du Bois rebuked Dean Acheson, the United States Secretary of State, the Peace Information Center heard from the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice demanded that the PIC register as a foreign agent of the USSR. The USSR was not the PIC's handler, and Du Bois was not one of their agents. He would be no agent to anyone but himself. Rather than going to war with the Department of Justice, he disbanded the PIC in 1950. But this was not good enough for the Department of Justice. They still insisted that the PIC register as a foreign agent, even though it no longer existed. When the DOJ didn't get his satisfaction, Du Bois was arrested and indicted as an unregistered agent for a foreign power. Later, a federal judge would direct Du Bois' acquittal because the prosecution had brought no case. This entire thing was designed to intimidate it. Du Bois felt vindicated, but the good feelings did not last long. Now remarried, Du Bois was vilified during the difficult McCarthy period. He watched friends and associates, notably poet Langston Hughes and actress Leah Horne, be discredited. Bois's life became harder because few periodicals wanted to carry his articles. Book publishers rejected his manuscript and his speaking engagements dwindled. He was unable to travel outside of the continental United States because the State Department voided his and his wife's passports. To get his passport back, he would have to comply with the State Department's request that he was a communist, and he would never go along with that. As the hysteria escalated, Du Bois became increasingly disillusioned with the United States and further explored communism. Du Bois would speak out against the Cold War, capitalist exploitation colonialism, and the international mistreatment of African people. He foresaw a period of socialistic pan-Africanism, and in 1955 he wrote, "African Negroes, freed from their baseless fear of communism, will again begin to turn their attention toward activity in Africa." In 1958, Du Bois got a new lease on life when the Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional to deny passports because of politics or refusal to state them. Du Bois began traveling the world again, having received several invitations from abroad. Du Bois would attend the Stockholm Peace Conference, where he would deliver an address. After visiting Czechoslovakia and Germany, Du Bois had spent 5 months in the Soviet Union. Having visited the Soviet Union on several previous occasions, Du Bois would marvel at the country's continued progress for employment, housing, education, and the status of women and race relations. After this visit, he lobbied endlessly for increased Soviet interactions with Africans for more research on that continent. Du Bois also visited the People's Republic of China. China served as a reminder that people of color could engage successfully in socialism. He noted that majority of the people in the world lived under socialism and declared that agrarian socialism was the economic system of the future. He believed that African Americans, given the history of mistreatment, could benefit from this type of social system. Upon returning to America, Du Bois expressed grave pessimism that blacks could ever achieve economic and political justice under capitalism and continued to advocate for a connection with Africa. He now had a special relation with Kwame Nkrumah, who was the first prime minister and president of Ghana, and supported their revolution. In 1960, Du Bois had one long-standing unfulfilled objective: to publish his Encyclopedia Africana, which would explore every aspect of black life. He contacted scholars, funding agencies, and anyone that would listen to help him accomplish this project. Du Bois first conceived of the Encyclopedia Africana in 1908 as a complete history and achievement of people of African descent designed to bring about a sense of unity to African diaspora. Unable to raise the needed funds, Du Bois was unable to revisit the project until 1935, but was disrupted by personal battles. After Du Bois was invited to move to Africa, he pledged to finally publish his work, but was never realized before his death. Du Bois died on August 27th of 1963 at the age of 95 and was given a state funeral in Ghana. William Edward Burghardt Du Bois was never able to create an empire in Africa, but he did make a name for himself in social sciences and literature. Du Bois was most often remembered for his counterpoint to the Atlanta Compromise and for his greatest literary achievement, The Souls of Black Folks. Du Bois's role as one of the founders of the NAACP and the crisis propelled him as a leader in the African American community. While he had philosophical differences with other African American leaders like Booker T. Washington, Marcus Garvey, and Walter White, later in life, he would ironically share similar views to Booker T. Washington and economic advancement versus political activism. He would move towards a more democratic socialist outlook and push for world peace and anti-proliferation of nuclear weapons. The Du Bois of 1903 and the Du Bois of 1950 were almost completely different men. Through all of this, he did his utmost to uplift the lives of African Americans, convinced that when people are regarded as the least are raised up, the whole world gains. And for 95 years, Du Bois attempted to raise the lives of the African American community. Thank you. This has been One Mic. I'm your host, Country Boy. Once again, if you like this, you enjoy this, consider donating to our Patreon page. It's linked down in the description. Also, rate us on Apple Podcasts. Give us 5 stars. And listen to The Cut for all your pop culture needs. Peace.
All agree with me. Thank you.